Hello and welcome to the Next Stage Press podcast, where we talk theater and playwriting with the various playwrights of Next Stage Press. I'm your host, Gene Cato, and for the next half hour or so, we'll be speaking with New York playwright Penny Jackson about her experience developing her powerful play, I Know What Boys Want, her thoughts on the state of cyberbullying, as well as her experience writing for film versus theater. Penny, hello and welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Gene. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm so excited to talk about all these wonderful topics.
Yeah, well, we're thrilled to have you. It is it's great to finally hear your voice. You know, you and I have communicated over the years, and now I finally can put a voice to it too. So it's wonderful to actually hear you. Whenever we start these things, I just want to always like to have the playwrights kind of tell everyone about themselves as we go through and roll through the Next Stage Press playwrights. I want everybody to know as much as they can about the wonderful writers that we have. So I'll start off by just going, go ahead and give us a brief history of Penny Jackson.
Well, I was born, raised, and still live on the Upper West Side in Manhattan. I do not know how to drive, so I am a true New Yorker.
Oh, wow.
I attended Barnard College on the Upper West Side, a women's college, which really influenced me, and that's when I really began writing full-time. There was really no playwriting classes when I went to college. It was just fiction writing. So I did mostly fiction writing, but I had to go across the street to Columbia University. At that point, Columbia was all male, interestingly enough. And they produced two of my short plays, and then I think Barnard got a wind, and they had a one-act play contest, and I submitted, and I won. So I was very torn when I was applying to graduate schools to focus on playwriting or fiction writing, and my college advisor at the time really dissuaded me from playwriting programs. She
really
wanted me to get an MFA in fiction and have nothing to do with theater. And I think, thinking about it now, you know, decades later, she knew that playwriting, and this is the 80s, was very limited for women. I mean, think of a woman playwright in the 80s, maybe Wendy Wasserstein. And I think she felt that I would have much more opportunities writing fiction. And I did, I was working as a literary agent reading fiction at the time than applying for theater, and there weren't really that many playwriting programs back in the 80s anyway. So I was a novelist. I had a novel titled Becoming the Butlers that was kind of a young adult novel that was chosen by the New York Public Library as one of the best novels of the year for young adults, and I wrote a lot of short stories. I have a short story collection. And out of these short stories that were published by Untrained Reads about 3 years ago, I developed a lot of plays. They were inspiration for plays. And one story, My Dinner with Schwartzy, is now my first short film.
Oh, wow. Wow, really? So that originally started out as a short story of yours?
Yes, absolutely. And what's fascinating about it, it was published in 1986. And it's about a young, but she's about 16, she's living in New York, and that was a time, you know, during the punk rock scene, and she really wants to, you know, make it like Blondie, be someone who's playing at Max's Kansas City, and she meets this older male rock producer who takes her under his wing, and she kind of meets the other women he's used and dumped. And I was working with a director, Melissa Skirball. We did a dramatization of many of these short stories at a theater downtown New York called Dixon Place. And after the Harvey Weinstein story broke, Melissa, who is a film director and a screenplay writer, called me and said, "This is our moment to make a short film based on My Dinner with Schwartzy." And it really worked. And it's nuanced. It's not like Schwartzy is this evil man. He's just, you know, we really tried to make it even in this film, to kind of show why this girl was attracted to him, but she's kind of falling down the rabbit hole. There's lots of Alice in Wonderland references.
Oh, yeah.
And my short play Before, which is about gun violence and was chosen as one of the best short plays of 2016 by Applause Books, was also originally a short story.
Oh, wow. So you've had a lot. You've had some of these works and stuff that have really your fiction writing has had a pretty hefty influence on your playwriting, huh?
Well, one thing I think that really helps me as a playwright, which I see other playwrights struggle, I have an MFA in fiction. I first went to from Stanford University, and then I finished up at Boston University, is I learned how to write a beginning, middle, and end. And a lot of plays that you see now, I just saw two plays last week that absolutely just petered out at the end. And
right.
I think that has helped me in my craft.
Yeah, I could see where that would be, because, you know, I mean, there's very few playwrights, I think, that could, you know, Sam Shepard was the king. What did they always often call him? The king of middle, to where all he had was basically the middle portion of a play. But there are a lot of plays that it just seems like that they run out of gas a lot of time at the end. So I guess going back and using a fiction structure in order to overlay that onto playwriting would probably be extremely beneficial in that process, just being able to economically tell a story and but also get to some sort of satisfying resolution.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that helps me with 10-minute plays, because 10-minute plays to me are like a short story. And I find 10-minute plays actually very easy to do. I find full-length plays very challenging. Writing a short screenplay was actually easier than writing a full-length play.
That's interesting. You are now in the podcast series that we've had. You're the third playwright that we've actually brought up the 10-minute play with. And it's funny, because the thoughts on them are it seems like there's a wide range of, for some people, you know, writing the 10-minute play is one of the most difficult thing in the world. And for other people, it comes naturally whenever you just are able to lay down that beginning, middle, and end and get in there and get out. And that's interesting. So you say 10-minute plays are very easy for you to write, huh?
Well, I wouldn't say easy, but it's easier for me.
Easier.
I also think there's limitations can really help a writer. You have to tell the story in 10 pages, and
yeah,
that helps. With a full-length play, I'm just going on and on. I don't even know what page I'm on. I'm losing track of the characters. I find that challenging. A 10-minute play, I know where they are. They're usually in one room, in one place, and I don't have to worry about them leaving or exiting or anything
right.
like that.
No scene changes, none of that stuff. It's get in and get out, and you get in and get out of the story. So, all right, terrific. Well, I want to get into some of your work, because it's interesting that you bring up this thing with how back in the 80s, you know, I'm trying to rack my brain right now and thinking about who it was, you know, as far as women playwrights go back in the 80s. You're right. Wendy Wasserstein was like the almost singular female playwright that we had that was in the, you know, just the mainstream theater circles back then, because Paula Vogel didn't come until later on. And
right.
But I'm sitting here racking my brain trying to figure out, isn't that terrible? It's a travesty thinking back over that it was I can't even think of a female playwright that other than Wendy Wasserstein that was like really out there during
You're
that
right.
time period. And that's interesting that you were in New York and back in that time, just there were, as far as playwriting for women goes, there weren't very many opportunities. Now let's jump forward to 2018. We are in a, shall we say, very tumultuous times right now, politically and creatively. And this is a big time for women that we're living in right now. And we published a play of yours called I Know What Boys Want. And I want to start with that, and then we'll kind of move on to the political climate and how it's differed from the time that came out and to where we are right now. So let's start with this. Can you talk a little bit about the origin of this work and what was it that really drove you to tell this story?
Well, I will first say I wrote this play 5 years ago, and so much has changed in terms of cyberbullying. We now have a president who cyberbullies, and but so at the time there was an article about I guess she was a high school junior in Staten Island, and she was at a party and was drunk and was filmed having sex with her boyfriend, and it was put on the internet. Now there are rules that are much stricter on
right.
the internet about this material, but back then it was kind of the Wild West.
Right.
You could post anything. And this girl committed suicide. She jumped in front of a train. And, you know, I was working at that time with Joan Kane, the director, and she said to me, we both said, wouldn't it be nice to, you know, helpful for these young women to hear and see a play that shows them fighting against their bullies and winning, even though it may be at great cost. And so I wanted to write a play that explored, you know, this, it was a fairly new topic at the time, 5 years ago,
right,
cyberbullying. And my protagonist, Vicky, who, you know, is helpless as these videos keep going on, various porn sites. You know, revenge porn is now the term for what is going on with Oliver, this young boy who's putting these videos. But revenge porn wasn't even a phrase then, 5 years
right
ago.
Sure.
So she tries to fight back, and she does fight back, and she does stop the videos, but it's a great emotional cost to her and her mother. And I was also interested in the mother's response to what is going on, because a lot of women of my generation still can't comprehend what this hatred that's on the internet.
Right.
And so I was very, her mother's is named Margaret, so I wanted to explore Margaret's point of view as well. And then I knew I had to have a sympathetic male character, because you can't have all the guys in your play be all evil, because they're not. There's some, you know, they're not.
Right.
So I created a character, Ted, who is sickened by what is happening with this porn revenge and this cyberbullying. And Hannah, who's they're both a little bit outsiders, and they become, you know, girlfriend and boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
So I really tried to balance the light and the dark. That's what I'm always trying to do, and show various perspectives. And it would be, you know, the play is outdated. I just read the script right now, and, you know, kids, they don't go anywhere near Facebook. Snapchat didn't even exist when I wrote this play.
Right.
And I think if someone had told me 5 years ago that the President of the United States was going to use the internet as a tool to bully and intimidate people in the way my teenagers do in my play, I would have never believed it.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. And it seems like that this is one of these plays that just as quickly as technology evolves, the things on the inside of it also could be updated almost at a rapid pace, because, I mean, it does. The tools and the mechanisms in which, life evolves and all of that is at a rapid pace. You're right. So the climate today is, it's much different than it was 5 years ago. And I would imagine
But Me Too did not exist.
Yeah, exactly. And I would imagine let me ask you this. When the play had its first run, and what was the audience's response given the political climate back then, and for a play, if it were to be mounted today, it may very well be a very different play, and the audiences would have a completely different take on it. What do you think it would be today versus what it was back then?
That's a great question, Gene. When this play was first produced 5 years ago, there was a lot of emotion and anger in the audience. And I remember one young woman sobbing her heart out throughout the play. It was really hard to even hear the actors.
Yeah.
And afterwards, we went up to her and asked how she was doing. And she had known the young woman who actually had committed suicide in Staten Island. It was one of those crazy, scary coincidences.
She just happened to be there, huh?
Well, we actually had a talk back. Now, let me back up track.
Okay.
We had a talk back, and I mentioned this young woman, but she was still very emotionally moved. What I liked about the production is we had several generations in the audience. So there would be elderly people who were interested in this topic because they didn't understand it. There would be parents who were there because their children were experiencing cyberbullying. And, of course, there were young people. And I had two productions of this play, and one of the actresses who plays Vicky was a victim of cyberbullying.
Wow.
So I also think then there was a sense of helplessness 5 years ago. Now with the Me Too movement and this unity of women, I would sense that women would still be very upset, but feel more empowered to take action.
Wow. That's so yeah, it would be exactly what. So did you have a, how long was the talk back? Did you have it on numerous nights, or was it one night that you had it? And what were some of the comments that came back from the audience members? You brought up about them, the different age groups that were in there. So what were some of the comments that you got?
Well, I would say there was a lot of, I had one fascinating scientist for a talk back, Heather Berlin, who talked about how the brain changes when you're on the internet all the time and you do not feel emotions and you're protected. You know, you're, you know, bullying someone on the screen as opposed right in front of you. And a lot of people were very angry that this was happening and frustrated that schools were not taking more action. I do remember that. And I think now, 5 years later, schools are more responsible. At that point, I do remember a school saying, cyberbullying is outside school hours. It's not our business. And I'm very happy to say that schools are much more involved now with talking about cyberbullying and perhaps even, you know, expelling students who are doing it.
Right, right. Well, I know what boys want. You have some very powerful women in this play. And
yep.
So what is the main takeaway that you would want? I start off by saying, just because Vicky is the target in your play, I would start off by saying, young woman, what is the takeaway that you would want young women to have in this? But also, feel free to open up. What is the takeaway that you want women in general to have with this play?
I want them to feel empowered. Absolutely empowered. And this is going on in New York right now, where women are sitting next to each other in the subways, protecting each other. And particularly with adolescent girls, I was a high school teacher for a long time. And when the adolescent mind, if something terrible happens, you don't have a sense of what will happen next week or next month or next year. It's like your present is the day. And I think that's why a lot of young men and women, unfortunately, take their lives because they cannot see a future. But what I hope when people see this play, it's open for discussion, be it your parents, your teachers, your best friend, and, you know, just look at each other and say, this has to stop. We can stop it. And that, if I can stop one cyberbullying attack, then my play is successful.
For sure. For sure. All right. Well, let's see. Let's move on to your. You have been actually writing for the screen recently. You mentioned your short film, My Dinner with Schwartzy. So, I'd like for you to talk a little bit about what the difference is in writing for film versus writing for the stage, and then we'll move on and talk about a couple more of your works here. But tell us a little bit about what you found over the years, because you have a very unique perspective now of starting off as a fiction writer and then moving into playwriting and then moving into screenwriting. So let's talk a little bit that, and tell me from your perspective what are some of the differences for you and some of the challenges or some of the liberating factors whenever you're writing or whatever. Tell us about that.
Well, I would say the greatest challenge is dialogue. So screen is a medium where instead of dialogue, you use visual imagery. And I'm a playwright who likes to use dialogue. So our first draft, luckily I was collaborating with my director, who is a screenplay writer. So I would have these long lines of dialogues and monologues, and we would have to throw them out because, you know, it just, that's not the way film works. So I had one big chunk of dialogue that we actually changed into a song, because my protagonist, Fiona, is a singer. And that was really exciting because we were trying to figure out how could we communicate these emotions, not through dialogue, and she does. So we decided to write songs. So she writes one song about her frustration, about not making it as a singer, and then another song, which is really beautiful, when she's alone in this car with this middle-aged man, and she's talking about how scared she is as he's trying to press pills into her hand so she gets, you know, complacent. And so giving up dialogue was difficult for me at first. I don't understand the vocabulary of camera.
Right.
And that was something I had to learn, and I'm still learning. Also, in terms of screenplay writing, you have to really, really depend on your cameraman and your cinematographer, because you will write a scene that just maybe the cameraman, it just doesn't work visually. But
right.
What was interesting about Schwartzy is we were adapting a short story and not a play. And I had read somewhere that it's much easier to adapt a story than a play into a film because you don't have that much dialogue to begin with in a short story.
Is it?
So
is,
if I was, yeah.
Do you find it? Is it? I don't mean to interrupt you on that, but do you think it's the descriptive nature of fiction writing that allows it? Because I mean, it is a. You know, normally whenever you're just writing a screenplay, you would think that it's all about the visuals, and it seems like that fiction would give you, you know, the kind of the nature of it is creating visuals in your head because you don't have that much dialogue. And you say you think that is much more helpful, you think?
Absolutely much more helpful, particularly in our final scene. The visuals are really stunning. I had a descriptive passage about this young woman is looking at the lights and skyscrapers, and they're going out one by one. It's supposed to symbolize her realization that if she sticks around with this older man, that her lights are going to be extinguished. And just visually, with the camera panning over these skyscrapers with the lights and her singing, it was just really extraordinary. And what's nice about film versus theater is that film is permanent. This film is going to stay around. When you have a theater piece, you have a three-week run or maybe a longer run, and then it's gone. It's vanished.
Right.
It's in print, but it's not the same.
Right. The dream is over at that point, and then it resets itself for the next time. But film is going to burn forever. Yeah, that's true. That is very true. So My Dinner with Schwartzy, like I said, you kind of brought this up a little while ago. Can you talk a little bit more, the Harvey Weinstein influence on that film? Can you talk about that?
Yes. Well, as I said, this film was prompted because of the Harvey Weinstein story, because Schwartzy is very much like Harvey Weinstein in that, you know, asking favors of young women and so they can be in his films, but with our film, it's so they can be, you know, in his records. I mean, this is the 80s, so we still had records. And again, you know, when we wrote this screenplay, Melissa Scorbell and I, we did not want to create this monster because, you know, I really like nuanced characters.
Right.
So the minute you see this guy, if he was a monster, you would turn off as a viewer. So he's very charming. He's very funny. He seems to, you know, really care for this young 16-year-old. But then when his former girlfriend, who he dumped, he just has a habit of the minute they turn 26, he gets rid of them, comes in and you see what a complete mess she is, you realize that this man is a monster. And then when you see him trying to dope her up with pills. So it was a gradual process. And, of course, you know, this is not about Harvey Weinstein. It's just about men who have power and who abuse it, and these young women who at first are thinking, oh, he can help me, and then realize that they're treading down a very dangerous path.
Wow. That sounds wonderful. So where is My Dinner with Schwartzy? Is it in, are you putting it in festivals, or is it, where's it playing right now?
Oh, I wish it was playing right now. We are submitting it to film festivals right now.
Yeah.
And if you follow me on Facebook or on Instagram, or our hashtag is Schwartzy Schwartz, you'll find out. But I would say probably not till a couple of months. See, even though I'm talking a lot about film, my heart is still writing plays.
Well, we're going to move on to your next play right here, because there was another work of yours that I think fared well in the Big Apple called Bitten, which has now been revised, and you expanded it, and it's now titled The Battles of Richmond Hill. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, The Battles of Richmond Hill. Richmond Hill, Queens, is a very remote part of New York, very hard to get to, and it was once a lot of Irish lived there, and now I would say it's mainly Guyanese, and it also was a site of, Brooklyn was a site of the battles during the Civil War, and I was very interested in challenging myself, and instead of writing about teenage girls, I wanted to focus on an elderly woman. And I have many friends who are older female actors who are, feel that there is ageism in the theater, which is absolutely true.
Right.
You know, if there's an older woman character in her 70s, she's either has Alzheimer's or cancer, or she's the grandmother. And I wanted to create an older character who's sexy and charming and funny and also a little bit losing herself. So my main character, her name is Sheila O'Connor, and she's lived in Richmond Hill all her life. Her daughter was a drug addict, and she had to raise her grandson, Brian, who's now a doctor. And she recently lost her husband, Frank, and this pub in this last Irish bar in Queens is really now her home, and it's kind of a refuge for other elderly people who really have lost their families, and it's their family now. But Sheila, unfortunately, has become an alcoholic since the death of her husband and has nearly burned down her apartment and now is pretty much homeless. And the challenge, and this play takes place one night, is Brian, her grandson, arrives on a snowy night, and he needs to bring her to this assisted living home facility for her to look at it and hopefully move her in there. But his grandmother has no intention of leaving. She has a boyfriend who's Russian who keeps proposing to her, and the bar has so many memories of her husband, Frank. And Frank is very much part of the play. Even though he's no longer alive, he's in her mind another customer of the play.
All right.
And it's funny, it's dark, and again, it's a powerful woman. It's a powerful woman, but this time she's in her 70s, not 17.
That's fantastic. I know now you're going to have everybody is going to be wanting to clamor to get a copy of that. I can see that in theater companies across the nation. Everyone's going, all right, well, it's time to get this one going up there. So what was the evolutionary process of that, of taking it from, because you originally had it in one format. Did you put Bitten up and then get some feedback about needing to revise it and change it?
I'm working with a director now named Kathy Gail McGowan, who's really understands Irish theater. She's married to an Irish man. And she read the play and said, we can expand this. This could be a full length. And at first, you know, I didn't believe her, but so many one-act plays do evolve into full-length plays. And we together, you know, we thought about, we added characters and you know, I've gone through 14 or 15 versions of this.
Oh my goodness.
Had readings of it. And yeah, revision is really the heart of playwriting.
Right.
And unfortunately, a lot of productions I'm seeing right now have not been developed enough.
Right. Could use some revision. Do you like rewriting plays? I mean, is that an enjoyable part of the process for you?
I love it and I hate it.
Right.
Because, you know, I love it because I'll think, my God, this is working now. But then, as with any writer will tell you, you just hit a blind corner and you're like, what do I do now?
Right.
However, I think I am unique in that I knew the ending of the play. I like writing endings of plays before I even write the beginning.
Really? That's
and
interesting.
I knew exactly. Yeah, I'm very unique that way. I can't write a play unless I really know how it ends. And I like very powerful images at the end of plays. Probably one of my favorite plays is Jez Butterworth's Jerusalem. And the last 10 minutes of that play, the ending of the play, is one of the most powerful endings I've ever seen in any theater work, where you just can't even breathe. It was so powerful. I mean, it helped that Mark Rylance was the actor in that. But so I like to write endings, and this is with I Know What Boys Want as well, which the audience leaves kind of gasping. That's, if I can do that, I'm successful. I made it work.
Wow, that's wonderfully fantastic. I've never known of run across a playwright that starts with the ending and then works their way there. That's a very interesting way to write. It seems like that would be at least give you a target of what you're heading for, because you're right, there's so many plays that probably could use a rewrite or two, and because they don't, you spoke about the ending earlier about how plays lose their gas at the end of them, and then if you have a very strong image that you're working towards, it seems like that would be a nice little roadmap of how to get there.
Roadmap is an excellent metaphor. Absolutely. I feel much more secure if I know the ending, and then I'll somehow, it's the middle where I get lost. I
Right.
think I'm great with beginnings, I'm great with endings. It's the middle I need my GPS, so to say.
Right. Right. Well, speaking of powerful subjects, let's move on to your other one. You said that you have a play entitled Before, which tackles kind of the tough subject of gun violence, which is also another issue that we are dealing with in 2017/2018. What can you tell us about that?
Well, Before was kind of commissioned for a play against for a benefit at the Atlantic Theater against gun violence. And for the first time, I decided I was going to write in the point of view of a teenage boy. Now, I was very interested in writing about a normal soccer-loving, pizza-loving teenage boy, not someone who's mentally disturbed, who somehow is in possession of a gun. His best friend Josh has given him a present of a gun because his girlfriend has cheated on him. And at first, this young, this teenage boy, he's terrified of the gun. His mother, goes on gun control marches, but the gun becomes another character, and it kind of overtakes him, and he decides to confront this girl with this gun. And he has to make a decision. Is he going to shoot her? Is he going to go into the school and do a mass shooting? Is he going to go kill his father, who's now remarried and living in New Hampshire? And it brings up questions. I'm tired of hearing people say all the time, it's not the gun, it's the person. But I do think having a gun will create possibilities for you that perhaps you never thought about. And the ending, I leave the ending very open, where I don't want to ruin the play for anyone,
Right.
but I leave if he shoots someone or not. It's a monologue, it's a very powerful monologue, and it's gotten really interesting responses. I will say it was performed in Gambier, Ohio. I was at the Kenyon Playwrights Conference there. And it was good to hear an audience response that was not, the usual New York audience. And somebody from, I believe this man was from North Dakota, said, "Well, I really liked your play, but you have it all wrong, Penny." And then we had a discussion about gun control. And I find gun control to be an issue that's still really challenging to discuss with people. I was just with a group of women from Dallas, and they love their guns.
Yeah.
And it was very hard for me to talk about. It was like opposite sides.
For
But
sure.
if this play, offers an opportunity for people to discuss why they favor gun control or why they don't, then I'm all for it.
It's all about the discussion, I guess. The which is something that we probably could use an awful lot more in 2018 of is just basic human discussion. All right, well, we're up against it here, so I want to wrap up with a couple of other things. Are you currently working on another play or writing project that we can be looking forward to? And you also mentioned a novel that you have. Tell us a little bit about that, where people can get a hold of that.
Sure. Oh, okay. So my novel is called Becoming the Butlers, and by Penny Jackson, and you can find it on Amazon. I also have a collection of short stories, many of which have been turned into plays. So my Dinner with Schwartzy is included in there, as well as Before, the play about gun violence. That's also available on Amazon. If you Google Penny Jackson author on Amazon, you'll see both of my published books. I'm included in a lot of anthologies. I just have a monologue in Contemporary Monologues for a New Theater by Applause Acting Series, and also Best Scenes for Actors Over 50. So if you're an actor and you're looking for monologues, just go look at the Applause acting series, and you'll see several books where I also have a monologue in like Best Teen Monologues. And I love writing monologues. I have to confess, I really love writing monologues.
Well, there's certainly no shortage of need for those in the theater. That's also probably a good calling card into having people go out and look at the rest of your work, because actors always need them. So that's a great calling card to get in to have the rest of your works read.
Absolutely. And I think one play I'm particularly proud of was a play I wrote about refugees. Last year there was a festival in New York City called the Frigid Festival, and I was invited to write a play in the refugee plays. And I wrote a play called A Different Place about a refugee who, although he's speaking English to the audience, the people he meets, they can't understand him, but the audience can understand him. And that was a play that received very good reviews, and I really enjoyed writing about that subject, because it's a topic that's still very controversial in this country, as well as Europe. I just came back from Europe, and that's also an issue.
For sure. So how can people follow your writing adventures? Are you on social media?
Yes, I am on Facebook, Penny Jackson Writes. I am also Penny Jackson on Facebook. On Instagram, I am Penny Jackso for some reason.
Penny Jackson.
They wouldn't give me Penny Jackson. And Twitter, I have a great Twitter handle, Penny Playwright. So at Penny Playwright.
All right. Well, terrific. Well, that's all the time that we have for this episode. If you'd like to purchase a copy of Penny's play, I Know What Boys Want, it's available on Amazon.com. And you can read the first half of this play or any of Next Stage Press's works on our website at www.nextstagepress.net. Also, if you're hearing this podcast for the first time, you can find the other episodes on iTunes or Podomatic, and we're now on Spotify. Just search Next Stage Press and hit subscribe, and as always, they're free to listen to, and feel free to share us with the world through the wonderful marvel of social media, and please leave us a review so we can keep bringing you the types of podcasts you want to hear. If you'd like to get in touch with me, I can be reached on Twitter at Gene Cato or by email at genecato@nextstagepress.net. And feel free to follow Next Stage Press on Twitter at Next Stage Press or on our Facebook page at NS Press Podcast. Join us next time when we talk to Houston playwright Denise O'Neill about her play Fly in the Windshield, which gives us a taste of how theater can be used in the fight against addiction. Until then, keep writing plays, keep reading plays, and keep going to the theater and supporting new work. And as always, Penny, thank you so much for taking this time with us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, Gene, thank you. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this. And yes, everyone, go to theater and support playwrights.
Amen to that. All right. Bye-bye, everybody.